All right. Thank you all for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Thomas Thurston and Greg Hannon, who agreed to be interviewed. So Thomas is chief technologist at Ducera Partners, and Greg is the former CTO of WL Gore. He's currently planning his Hilton Head retirement. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'm Lee Green, and I run IRI's research and strategic initiatives. And as a part of IRI's work to bring you leading edge content on digitalization and AI, we hold webinars like this one every other month. And we also do monthly roundtable discussions on digitalization and AI. And we talk about practical applications and how everyone's doing and what's going on with that. So it's a great way to stay on top of it and not feel super overwhelmed by all the technology out there. And if you don't already receive those updates, I'll make sure that you get them. Just a few housekeeping items to get through before we can start the conversation. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We'll be distributing it as a podcast, so there won't be any visuals here today. And second, I just ask that you please hold all questions until the end, and we'll open the floor to questions, and you can either raise your hand and come off mute, or you can type the question in and I'll read it out for you. All right, now we've got all that out of the way. So again, Thomas, Greg, thanks for joining us today. And I'm going to ask both of you, you know, about your background and the work that you're doing. So Thomas, can you kick us off and tell us about yourself and about Ducera?
Yeah, thanks, Lee. I appreciate it. So I'm a data scientist, and my job is I analyze innovation both in companies and in the marketplace, but from a quantitative point of view. So for example, how can we better predict statistically if an innovation will survive or fail? Or how can we do this even when accounting for things like the market or corporate idiosyncrasies? And to do this well, we've had to invest heavily in our own AI and computing infrastructure. So at Ducera Partners, where I'm chief technologist, I think of it as a startup investment bank. So we started up about 7 years ago. The idea was, can we be disruptive in investment banking? And can we do that using technology and AI as a backbone of the company and the core of our strategy, and do things that other banks either can't do or have to do with a lot more cost and a lot more labor? And so in sort of the 7 years we've been going, we've done over 800 billion in transactions, so averaging about 100 billion a year. So it's been a really exciting kind of rocket ship to be on. And I really believe that it's because of that data. And we've done this all with less than 100 people, by the way. So I think really trying to maximize this idea of, can we get insights in the market? Can we actually turn those into value and transactions, and really relying on AI to do that?
That's great. Okay. And so, Greg, tell us about Gore.
Sure. So thanks, Lee, for having us today. As Lee said, my name is Greg Hannon. And until recently, I was the CTO for W.O. Gore & Associates. I spent over 30 years at Gore and retired in July of 2023. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with Gore, we're a global enterprise of about 11,000 associates, which generates about $5 billion in annual revenue. I held a number of different commitments during my time at Gore, and since 2017, I was their CTO. When I retired, my main responsibilities were really looking at material technology development and our innovation pipeline.
So just the easy stuff then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. So, Thomas, you helped use AI with decision making. Can you tell us about the tool that you developed and why you developed it? This is a great story. I can't wait for you to share it with everyone.
Yeah, you know, no, my pleasure. I mean, at this point, it's an entire division of people and everything too. I think it's gotten much broader, but maybe let's start with where it began. So maybe around 2005, 2006, I was at Intel in Oregon, and I was started working in an innovation group, so an acceleration group, an incubator that the company had at the time. And there were about 16 different projects. We were one of them, and it was everything you'd expect. This was actually set up as a separate quasi-autonomous group. We had our own building. I think we're the only ones at the time who had free coffee, so we thought that was pretty exciting. We didn't have a foosball table, but this was, but we were kind of that version at the time. And we had this exciting project, you know, with a small group of people. We thought, okay, you know, let's build the next $1 billion business for Intel, and won't that be fabulous? We'll have the best of both worlds, get to play startup, but get to be backed by a big company as well. And I think people on this call are probably chuckling at that idea, because as of course we all find out, over the next few years, we worked really hard on this project. We built it up to about 30 people. We were doing great in the market, but one day effectively we were told we weren't strategic anymore. And that wasn't a decision that had anything to do with us. It had been made in much higher stations than we were in. So 1 year we were very strategic. A couple of years later, suddenly the strategy had shifted and we weren't, and our project was ostensibly killed. So for me, that was rough, because I'd spent a few years working my guts out on this project. And for reasons really unrelated to it, it no longer was a thing. So I think that experience, I remember looking across the cubicles at the time when it was clear which direction our project was going, and seeing all these other smart people working really hard and just thinking, how often does this ever work, right? I had gone to thinking from starting, like, how could we possibly fail, to does anyone ever succeed when trying to do corporate innovation? Because at the time I was very demoralized. And I started asking around just what percent, because I have I had a statistics background and the data science work I've been doing prior to that. You know, just asking around, gosh, you know, what percentage of the time when we launch new products or new innovations, do they succeed? And I was still naive enough at the time to think there would be an answer. Oh, 13% or 20 or 80 or whatever the case may be. But of course, I realized that nobody knew, because nobody goes, or it's no one's job to go around big companies to all the different projects innovating and all the different groups and business units and tally it up and see what the batting average is, and start to analyze any of that from a really statistical point of view. So that was, I was angry. I had enough angst at the right moment. I had a little spare time and I decided I would take this on. And I wanted to figure out, first of all, just how often do projects succeed or fail? And then could we look at causality? Could we figure out, were there any correlations between any of the variables decision makers had when they funded projects and how those projects performed 5, 7, or even 10 years later? So I spent the next year or so as a kind of my passion. I had my day job at Intel still, but my side passion became trying to put together a data set of every prior innovation the company had ever done. And it was, there was no shared drive where this was neatly already waiting for me. It was anthropology. I had to run around. You'd hear people say things like, oh, I think we did a camera in the 90s. And I'd say, oh, well, do you know anyone who was on that project? And I'd buy them coffee and see if they had those old slides. And I would manually take those old slides or Word docs and try to take data out of them, or fields, and create fields in a database to begin to populate some kind of data. And it was really messy and incomplete, because not all decks are the same. But I spent over a year at this again. And eventually I had enough of a statistical sample and it was robust enough to start looking and analyzing for patterns. And we found something, and that's kind of where I can stop there. But that was a springboard upon which we started to realize, oh my gosh, it isn't pure chaos. It's not easy to predict by any means, but there do seem to be some bases upon which you can build predictions that are actually quite accurate in the real world. And so can we start to build this up? Because what I had done is just the tiny tip of the iceberg. And today, almost 20 years later, I'm still working on those same problems, only they've gotten wider as well as deeper. You know, we've shown a ton of success in terms of being able to do this, but we start, every time you answer one question, you realize there's 10 new questions you didn't know about. So it's I treat it like science. To me, it's just super fun. And then what's nice, though, is unlike a lot of other types of science, when you find a nugget out there in the marketplace, you can commercialize it almost right away. So you don't find that many eureka moments, but when you do, they have really high impact.
That's great. So that's how you're using it now, right?
Yeah, today we have over 25 million in just hardware and software infrastructure. We have 10 data scientists. We have a huge team and an organization, and we snowballed. So we started with some basic statistics. And of course, over time, realized there's all kinds of ways you can understand markets that most people aren't even aware of. You can predict things people aren't aware of. Most things, you know, like ChatGPT. I think 2 years ago, people would have said it's impossible. But the people who've been working on that AI would have said, no, we've been doing this for a very long time. It is a similar phenomenon where predicting if an innovation will succeed or fail, what the causality is, understanding how to model whether a company is going to kill their own project or the market's going to kill it. These sound kind of crazy, but actually, no, they're very reliably predictable. And you start getting bigger and bigger. And now we can look at entire marketplaces with thousands of companies, lots of complexity, and use AI to really find these patterns and these opportunities where us or the companies we work with can make deals happen, right, that really work in their favor.
And how is that different from just kind of general, you know, foresighting and weak signal scanning?
Yeah, well, maybe it's a continuation of that, right? I mean, I think it is a snowball, right? When you find something that works, you build on it and you build on it and you just keep at it. But yeah, no, I mean, I think if we look at this on a continuum, you know, insighting and foresight, you know, all of that is somewhere along this continuum. In terms of the amount of data you can look at, the types of nuances and markets you can see, the questions you can answer. I mean, yeah, just as you get more and more of these things and their accuracy gets higher and higher, I think you get into a very different space. You know, it's not just drawing a line through product sales and saying, okay, if we keep growing at this rate, it's much more like saying, okay, let's say this company, you know, wants to launch a brand new innovation that's never existed into a brand new market that, by the way, doesn't exist. How's that going to go, right? That's a very different question. And to be able to actually, I mean, there's no crystal ball, there's no magic. I mean, we don't have perfect, you know, we can't see into the future, but actually to make astonishingly accurate predictions and consistently over time, being able to model those environments through software. So think about it like a prototype. If you build a engine, you know, the wing of a plane, you know, you're going to put it through all kinds of simulations that are going to test all kinds of multivariate phenomenon. Imagine effectively being able to do that with a new product idea for a market that doesn't exist using data out there today. Because when people talk about a new market that doesn't exist, well, yeah, that end state may not exist yet. But all the pieces of it, the ingredients do, right? They're taking all the things that exist and putting them into a new place. So can you look at those ingredients computationally and statistically, which is a big data challenge, and actually simulate a product launch and be able to predict if it's likely to survive or fail? And do that, again, we can talk about accuracy and statistical confidence and all of that, but just do that very consistently. We find that most companies, you know, privately, or if you buy them a beer, you know, typically the survival rate of new innovations is between 10 and 15% at big companies. So that's a lot lower than I think most people outside of companies assume. But I think those of us that have worked on innovations, like I did, it's not a shock. But that yield, if you will, that 10 to 15% success rate, and most of those tend to be incremental, by the way, so not a lot of them are disruptive. That's been a very stubborn number in the 20 so years I've been studying this. And so despite all these advances that have come out and all these forms of innovation, accelerators, incubators, venture studios, all this stuff, that yield really hasn't moved this whole time. And wondering, how are we getting so much better at innovation, but we're actually not getting a statistically better outcome? So what you do in that case is you look for, through big data, you look for other examples or where there have been higher success rates or more successful outcomes. You aggregate those, and then you can start pattern matching in a different way. But anyway, I can keep going, or I can stop. I know I should probably let Greg go.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be coming back to you, Thomas. But Greg, can you talk to us about how you saw this applied in the kind of corporate world?
Sure. So in the commitment I mentioned I had around innovation, I was responsible for leading the pipeline across all four divisions. So we're looking at things from medical implantable devices, Gore-Tex fabric for outerwear, electrical, electronic products, and industrial products. So a very diversified group of businesses and projects that we would work on. And I don't know how many times, if you're like me, how many times I ask myself, how can we improve the overall effectiveness of our innovation efforts? Which project should we invest in? Which ones should we not? Which ones will survive both internally and externally? Because there's battles being fought on both fronts in any project team that is outside the norm, if you will. Is anyone working on a solution that is either similar to this for the same problem or dissimilar, a different way to get at it that would upend us as time goes on? And that list that goes on and on. I spent many hours thinking about how we do that. The other thing is, I've never met an innovation team that wasn't 100% convinced that they were the ones we should invest in. Not that anyone's biased, just there's a lot of confidence out there. And one of the things that I used to tell each of these teams is that the truth is out there. It's just a matter of when you find it, either now or later. The other thing that if you do a little bit of research in this area, some stuff from BCG, I think, would say that most startups and maybe disruptive projects and companies could be considered startups fail from a lack of customers, not from a failure of product development. So you develop the product, you set off and did what you thought you would do, but it doesn't work in the market. And that's something that is hard to predict, I think, of where it will go. Are you a new entrant to a different market? Are you an incumbent, et cetera? And when we teamed up with Thomas, one of the goals that I had was to use his group's efforts and tools to really look at that acceleration and how could we get more through the pipeline. Because as Thomas mentioned a minute ago, there's no crystal ball. So the only thing we had was time, and time to go quickly as we could. If you think about a medical product, it may take 10 years to get to market. Wouldn't you rather know in year one that it's going to be a problem when you get to the market, when you get to the end of that pipeline, or would you rather wait 10 years and find the same answer? So for us, it was really around how do we shorten that time of decision-making, either to stop, invest more, redirect, whatever it may be. And their tools are really helpful in helping us do that.
All right. So how would a company actually go about doing this internally? It sounds like it's a lot of work and a lot of, as you say, anthropology. So
I'll talk to you a little bit about what we did, and then Thomas can embellish on that. I'm a strong believer in the lean startup methodology. So we would actually run cohorts of projects, maybe 10 projects at a time over around a 10-week following Steve Blank's course at Stanford. We would have two people per project, a business lead and technical lead, and they would go out and hunt for a business model or problem to be solved. And when they got to the end, they made a recommendation, do we or don't we, or should we not invest more in this project? And that's at the point that we would bring Thomas's group in. And from a scenario, there was Thomas and his team would ask a lot of good questions around how the project's organized, who you see in the market, et cetera, et cetera. And then they would take that information from us and run simulations to see what the outcomes could be. And it would give us an opportunity to either adjust our inputs early on, or just, like I said, invest more because we got a winner, or less because we're not seeing it happen. So it was actually very straightforward on how to collaborate with Thomas and his team. And I think over the last few years that we were working together, we probably did about 130 to 140 projects with his group.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that the collaboration that we got to do was really precious to us, right? I think, as sort of the CTO role that I sit in, there's the transactional, like operational side of the business, but I actually still think of a lot of what we do as research. I mean, core R&D ourselves, right? And that's, I think, I tend to be guilty of gravitating to that too, because I like to get in the lab. I like to think about hard problems and try to figure out how to solve them. And I think there've been people like Greg, and opportunities to really collaborate that have been, I frankly consider it co-R&D, right? Where we get to look at the same problems together, but they have so much expertise, technical domain and otherwise too, that when we can get together and collaborate around this, our capabilities help and we get excited about that. But I think together we actually evolve because we're learning from each other. And for me, that's really the exciting thing about doing it. I think, all the capabilities we've talked about, we've built them primarily for ourselves at an investment bank, right? Okay, fine. And our investment bank, we do venture capital. We actually run a number of venture capital funds for companies as well. So that's not normal for an investment bank, but we've been successful there. We also do traditional bank stuff like M&A, complex transactions. But I mentioned that because I think the bar is high, right? Not everyone should just go out there and build a huge AI infrastructure and tools. I mean, my gosh, right? We're all staring at this problem today. Like, what do we do? And I would like to reframe the problem. If the question is, how do you start? Let's say somebody listening to this podcast is asking, okay, I work at a big company. How can I start to do this? And yeah, maybe I don't have an infinite time and budget and manpower. So I really do think that it can be so worthwhile to do a little bit of your own anthropology, frankly. To say, can you put together at least 30 projects that your company has, products your company has tried to launch or launched maybe even over the last, let's say 10 years, even whatever time frame you can get. And to try to find those rumors of those products if you don't already have them in mind and put them in a shared drive and begin to look at them and try to see what were those variables decision makers had. And can you form any type of, even if it's not a statistically correlated, but you know, even if you're just looking, can you see commonalities between what the variables were at the beginning and the outcomes were at the end? And even if you want to get really crazy, even just create a spreadsheet and try to put some of the, I mean, that's basic. That's not AI. That's not data science. But even that exercise, I've never once, I mean, I've done it a ton of times with folks that were either just colleagues or friends just because they were curious and they wanted to start. And there's plenty of other fancier, higher octane ways to start, but this is really precious. That exercise, not only do you almost always find amazing nuggets in there that are not only generalizable, but are specific to your company. You may have some idiosyncrasies in there that you can capture. You probably already know them, right? But just to actually have some of that data, it's for a little tiny investment of some time and enthusiasm, you always get back some pretty powerful results. And in the process of doing it, you discover gaps and things that just aren't, you know, you discover a lot even just by trying to put together a tiny list. So that may not be the answer you're looking for. We can talk about, again, higher powered ways to start. And of course, there's all these tools now out there if we want to talk about AI and what have you. But I actually think go grassroots. If you or someone who works with you or get an intern or someone can do this project, it'll probably be one of the most important things you can do for your innovation effort this year. and I really do mean that. And it very quickly, you could probably double your hit rate just by really doing that well. I mean, it's kind of remarkable because we all know this. I think anyone who's been in innovation any amount of time or has some of those battle scars, when you can tell a project is probably not going to do well in the market, or maybe it's going to do great, but you just know your company's probably going to kill this poor thing, even though it might be a great product. You just know it doesn't fit internally. And it's because your mind is triggering these variables and is doing pattern recognition, and we'll call it intuition. But those are patterns. You can write them down and make them explicit. And you're probably right. And you can test the degree to which you're right by making them explicit and nuance them in ways we don't do in our own brain. So anyway, I'll shut up there. But it might surprise people. I actually think that is a really powerful way. And it needs to be a snowball for most organizations, right? They're not going to go drop $25 million on a compute infrastructure, probably. So for free, with a little time, you can start. And as you learn things and begin to share them and grow what you're doing, it can move quickly. It's surprising what a little data can do.
And I imagine it's even more important right now as we're seeing a lot of people retiring and that knowledge going away to capture all of that and get them and buy them that coffee before they're gone. Great.
Yeah, by the way,
I'm pointing
case. Yeah, this data does expire as those people go to Hilton Head or
wherever.
Unless they stay in the game. Yeah.
So Greg, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that?
I think for us, I mentioned how many projects we did with Thomas and his team, but we did, as he mentioned, we started out small. He actually connected with somebody who I work with within Gore, He said, this looks interesting. I don't even know how the initial connection was made by this associate and Thomas and his team. And we slowly started getting together and meeting and talking things through and how we would do it. And then once it got going, we actually had people internally reaching out, can you help me look at my project? Because I need help to understand how I'm doing. What are my blind spots? What am I not seeing in the marketplace? It also gave us a lot of help when we tried to look for areas that we should collaborate, right? Most teams are pretty much set on going it alone. We'll do it all ourselves. There's a few companies that tend to do a little bit more inorganic, but most tend to stick with what they know and try and develop solutions on their own. And we learned a lot about who we should partner with in certain segments of the marketplace when we had a new product idea. And it would just make much more sense, but it's not a natural way of project champions, at least at core, thinking how things should work.
Okay. So before we start talking about, you know, getting beyond the Excel spreadsheets and moving into AI and how we can really advance it, what are some of the, like, the columns that you created for this, or the rows, depending on how you laid it out, I guess, in the spreadsheets?
Yeah, I think any sort of obsessive tendencies I had definitely went way too far when I was doing this. So I was interested in capturing external and internal variables, and that's what you get in a project deck, right? If you look at some old slides, and again, a lot of these were still Word docs because that's how long ago I was doing this. Remember when executive summaries used to be the way before PowerPoint became ubiquitous? But maybe we'll talk about some of the things we learned that are counterintuitive too. I mean, one, any way we defined the team, we couldn't pit the team with outcomes with any statistical confidence, which is shocking because we always tend to, and of course, a bad team can ruin anything. I mean, we know that, that's just a fact. But I guess I should say, you know, at Intel, if a project got funded, they might not have been rock stars on every team, but they were decent, right? They weren't a bunch of idiots, right? They were good enough to think of something and get it funded. So they'd already kind of made this threshold. And that funding might've been, you know, 100K for 6 months. It didn't have to be big, but what we found is really there wasn't variance within that subgroup. So you're already talking about people who probably meet the minimum criteria of competence. And there was no way to really look at the difference between a good or a great team. Statistically, we looked at everything we could think of, variable-wise, backgrounds, experience, some creative stuff. And then we went to secondary research because then I discovered that this is one of the most written things about in academia, or it used to be, you know, the effect of leadership on performance. Some of it's related to business, some isn't, but and the meta studies are great, but we couldn't really find anything that, you know, reliably put the impact of the team at more than 13% of the variance in outcomes, which again was a bit of a shock. But I think, okay, so statistically speaking, it's more about avoiding bad teams than it is trying to find rock stars. I think that's what we learned, right? But even being able to put a boundary around that variable and saying, okay, if that's 13% of the variance, you know, what's the other 80%+ of the variance? We also looked at, we looked at internal and external factors. I think this research I was doing at Intel snowballed so much that it went from being my side project, my passion project, to, as well as finding things, Intel kind of got behind it at one point, and Intel co-sponsored a research project that I led with Clay Christensen at Harvard, and I moved to Boston, and Clay got me an office by his, and really to look at innovation from a quantitative lens, combining the resources of the school and the company, and spent a whole year there. It was amazing, and I was able to talk to anyone that we could recruit, any smart people we could bring in and recruit to the project to contribute in any way, big or small, and we were able to get data from any company or nonprofit or fund or anyone who would want to collaborate with us as well. So it got to that scale before then I went off into venture capital and started to use it and funds there. But so along the way, one thing we learned, and I mentioned Clay Christensen because, you know, he had always found in A Course in Disruption theory that you shouldn't go into a new market as a new entrant with a sustaining or better performance strategy, right? He had found in his research that that was not good. We'd also found that in parallel in our data. We weren't using his language, but it was obvious it was the same pattern that he had found. So that was an interesting dovetail. But we were able to quantify that even. We found that when a company, no matter how big you are, you can be Intel or Microsoft or Tesla or Google, it doesn't matter. When you go into a new market for you, so you're a new entrant in that neighborhood, when companies go into new markets with better performing product, the survival rate is around 13%. So it's really, really low. So basically, never go into a new market with a better product, which, I mean, yes, you heard that right. And at Intel, you can imagine, like most great companies, like Agor, they exist because they built the best of what they do. And their engineers are trained to build the best. And they're pretty darn good at understanding what customers want and delivering a better version of it. So the entire conventional ethos of the core is better, better, better. And what we're saying is the minute you're a new entrant, never be better, or your odds are terrible. And there's other strategies we can tell you about that the odds are much better. But you know, getting an engineer to not build a better product is an unnatural act. So these are counterintuitive, but if you keep building better, you keep going head to head with the incumbents in every market you go into, and it's just easier for them, your competitors, to defend castles they already own and occupy than it is for you to go in and take their whole castle away. That's basically it. It's the competitive causality that diminishes the odds of the new entrant. And we found that it's insensitive to spend statistically. It doesn't matter how much money you're willing to lose trying. Doesn't seem to matter how long you want to try. There's all of these things. It doesn't matter how much better. So a lot of companies are like, okay, well, we can't be in there with better product. What if it's 100x better? Or, you know, we looked at all the magnitudes we could get data for. Didn't move the statistics one bit. You actually, in fact, there's a few strategies with very high odds, but the contrasting one that's fun to talk about is, instead of better, if you're actually cheaper and worse than everybody else, your odds go up roughly, you know, to around 63 to 65%. So from 13 to 65, you can, you know, almost 4 or 5x your odds of being a new entrant at any company by being cheaper and worse as opposed to better. I mean, these are the kinds of things you learn, and it just does your head in, right? But anyway, I should hand the mic, so to speak, to Greg. But I wonder how does that resonate with what you did or didn't see at Gore, or what in your experience?
Yeah, I think so. Along those lines, I think the company's history has a lot of influence on their DNA and what they think they can or can't do. And to Thomas's point, if you're a new entrant in an existing market with a better product, something a company like Gore, my example, we could engineer anything. We could do it, you know, hands down, better than anyone else. But that doesn't guarantee you success in the marketplace, because incumbents are not willing to let go. So what we found more than anything, it was a shock to people's system that if you built a better mousetrap, you may not be able to sell it to anybody or sell it well. So we tended to start focusing our efforts in areas of market where I wouldn't say necessarily lower cost or worse performance, but underserved. For whatever reason, the product over here couldn't get to this consumers over here, whoever they might be, and start out that way and ease your way into the marketplace. And we have a lot of examples at Gore of doing that over the years. I think you as a company, you begin to believe that you can do anything through engineering, and that's really not the way it turns out in the real world.
Yeah, building on that, another one of these really high result strategies for new entrants is, I mean, I'm summarizing this dramatically, but it's effectively a blue ocean, right? Finding a market segment that's being overlooked, just like Greg said, where there are no incumbents. So if you go in, you're not stealing customers from anyone. So there's no one cares. And your odds again go up into the 60, 65% range, and you can be brand new. So even just realizing you can take the same idea and pivot its features and its strategy and go for a different market, just a different beachhead, can have a huge impact on your odds. And so once you start to recognize those kinds of things and replicate those patterns across your portfolio, you just get a better yield, the more projects succeed and hit goal. So it's just like a manufacturing line, right? You get better inputs, you get better outputs, you get a better process. It's as much as it's multivariate and complex and tangible and intangible, it's still not infinite, right? You can start to understand these things even from an actuarial or statistical sense. And right away you get a payoff, right? If you can identify it and act. The harder part is getting people to change their behavior, like finding the insights 1,000 times easier than getting people to actually do something different, right? I think that there's a challenge.
I'm sure.
I think the Achilles heel, and I love Greg's perspective. What we're finding statistically is one of the biggest challenges that big companies face when trying to incubate or launch new innovations is creating a high degree of autonomy for very small projects. And it's a slightly different topic, but that is really an Achilles heel. I think companies can be cotton on to better strategies. They can improve the quality of their projects and portfolios and their innovations. And they'll still see most of those fail if they can't figure out how to effectively manage wholly owned subsidiary structures for those small projects and know when to do that and how. And it seems a little obvious, and every big company knows how to create autonomy to that level for their big businesses. Most big companies have big businesses or units that are separate, or they'll do a huge acquisition and leave it alone. It's not that companies can't manage high levels of autonomy. It's that they don't know how to systematically do it and govern it for small projects, things that are little, and to do that and scale it up. And it can't just be an incubation group. Like I was in at Intel, because if you're just an employee with a blue badge in a separate room with coffee, everything you do still creates liability and risk and reputational risk for your parent company. I mean, so a parent company can't have 100 innovation projects doing God knows what, getting them sued all over town and ruining their reputation. They can't give autonomy to those projects so the projects are upset because they can't just run their business. They have to spend all their time managing up. The company's upset because they're not getting anything out of those projects. So the causality is, until you can protect the core from liability, both reputational and legal, you can't then free the project to go run itself like an actual business. So you get everybody's wish, but you have to create that barrier. And after 30 years of incubators and accelerators and all these different structures, Clay Christensen helped. We all know they're better than trying to innovate from the core, but the yield hasn't gone up. Why? Because the causality is still there. You still have to micromanage them at the end of the day. You can't let them just go get a website. You can't let them just go, can't let them do anything really, because of the liability that they represent, until you create a structure. A legal structure and a governance structure that insulates the core, and figure out how to manage and scale that. So that's a much harder problem statistically that we've identified in this data. The fixes are known. It's not unknown. These are known knowns, but companies, the ones that have done this have been really reaped the rewards, and that's a whole nother, it's remarkable, yeah. But companies generally haven't, because it's a heavy lift and it's a lot to ask for a little tiny project. And that's how they always see it. Well, yeah, if you succeed, little project, someday, if you're big enough, we'll give you autonomy, is what they say. But that day never comes, because they don't live that long, because when they really need it is much, much earlier. And I think Gore has been really innovative. I mean, I could be wrong with someone like Gladwell or someone. He'd even written a story about how Gore really modularizes its innovation and breaks up these projects into smaller autonomous units. And that was one of the things that made Gore a fascinating company for us to work with.
Yeah, and I just go back in our history, we were better at it early on. We lost our way, and now we're just getting back to it again. Gore started as an electronic products company, selling wire insulation for wire and cable assemblies. So a very straightforward type of business. Bill Gore, the founder, had made an expanded Teflon tube that he brought on a ski trip with him. And he handed it to one of his friends who was a surgeon. Surgeon said, this could be an artificial artery or vein. This could be a revolutionary in the market. So Bill Gore, the founder of the company, started up this little side project. And the electronic products group, all they would do is complain about it, because you guys are just siphoning off all the profits we're making into a venture that's going nowhere. But without Bill Gore's ability as leader of the company to keep them separate, it would have been doomed. More recently, we have had two examples, and Thomas's team was helpful in both of these. We were working on a solution for Crohn's disease. If you're familiar with that digestive, you can get fistulas. It can be very debilitating for people. And we had collaborated on a project with the Mayo Clinic on how to move that forward. But we were concerned bringing it internally to Gore that our cardiovascular business, which has nothing to do with Crohn's disease, would shut it down over time. And this gets into the whole nuances of keeping them separate. Quality system differences had to be addressed. You know, you could be separate in that room where Thomas said right next door having coffee, but you got to use our quality system purchasing, got to use everything that the big company does. And it just doesn't work for the small company that's got five or six people trying to, you know, make their way into the marketplace. There was another one we did, which was working on right now, an artificial, I kind of speak like I still work there because I sort of help out every now and again. An artificial cornea the same way, right? Getting into ophthalmics is very different than cardiovascular. Quality system, again, is a big impediment. So you're autonomous, but you have to do X, Y, Z because that's how we do things. Doesn't really get you the autonomous state that you're seeking. So we use Thomas and his team to help us really identify those things that would allow us to get that separation. And what does autonomy actually mean? And how does that translate into day-to-day operations of both the existing business and the new projects?
Okay. So conscious that we want to leave time for Q&A. So far, you know, this is a digitalization discussion and we're dealing in spreadsheets. So AI, you know, once you get beyond, you know, 30 projects in a spreadsheet, how do you scale that up and how can you use AI to actually help you in all this so that you're not going crazy?
Yeah. I mean, we can jump around that. I mean, it's a big question. So some of the things I do, so in the venture cap, I'll just use a case study, for example. So we run, again, a few different venture capital funds. How does AI help us in a way that makes us different or perhaps, you know, have an advantage over traditional venture capitalists? Because there's about roughly 10,000 venture capital firms in the world, right? There's lots of them. A normal venture capitalist, the sort of one of the foundations of their competitive advantage for a traditional VC is that they have in their mind, or they're selling that they have this access to a robust pipeline of high quality deal flow, right? That is kind of a cornerstone. Hey, I know where I have a relationship with university, or I'm just have a presence in Silicon Valley or whatever it is. I get the good deals coming to me. That's what most VCs are saying. And that's a real big differentiator. And I think if a company, for example, or anyone wants to start a venture capital unit, that's kind of one of the challenges. Like, how are we going to get the deals? How are we going to, you know, it's not, you can't just announce it and get all the good deals coming to you, no matter what your company is. You'll get deals, but you might not get the good ones, right? So how do you, you know, the bad ones will find you first, right? Because they're looking for money every day. So this idea of how do we get the good deals coming to us? Now, it's always been a labor-intensive business in venture capital. I mean, when I worked at Intel Capital, I believe, had over 200 investment directors, which are VCs running around, not to mention other support staff and other folks. So it's a massively expensive, labor-intensive business. You know, it's flying around, going to conferences, going to trade shows, building relationships. I mean, it's a ton of work. It's also kind of arbitrary, right? So just because I, as proposed VC, flew to an event and was at the cocktail hour and met a cool startup and kind of cottoned on to them and having them come back to the office and pitch us next week. I mean, that's pretty random. I mean, there could have been 50 startups competing with that one. I just happened to meet that one. There was some chemistry and now I want to give them money. Right? So there's an arbitrariness and there's a challenge there in deal flow. And it's about how do I create that inbound deal flow? You want the best deals, again, coming to you. That's completely irrelevant in the way we manage venture capital funds. We don't care about deal flow. It's not something I think about. Why is that the case? It's because of AI. So for example, one of our capabilities with our infrastructure is I can effectively keyword any criteria I want and find all the companies doing that anywhere in the world at any size. So imagine you type in, oh, I'm looking for carbon capture companies that are focusing on certain type, I mean, whatever technical language, whatever requirements you want, you effectively put in those things describing the kinds of companies you want to look at strategically. It'll find them, and it'll usually find hundreds, if not thousands of them, which is always a shock, because most of the time when I start a query, I assume there might be like 30 companies in the space, and I'm always finding there's so many more. And that alone shifts the entire way I approach and think about the market, because it's one thing trying to navigate 20 competitors, another 2,000, right? It's a different strategy that you're going to need. So being able to effectively pull all the companies, see everyone on Earth, and then we can even estimate their valuations through AI, which is quite a large process, and we can see how their valuations have changed over time through AI, but we do that synthetically. So yeah, we have PitchBook subscription, of course, but that's not what I'm looking at. We have our own independent estimate of what their valuation ought to be through AI, and we can look at that on a trend line and see how it's doing. So imagine instead of running around to cocktail hours, I can wake up in the morning with my cup of coffee, see all 11,000 companies in some market, whittle it down to the 30 that are really relevant and tight to my strategic intent. I can see they're all startups. They may not even have PitchBook profiles, right? They might not even be on LinkedIn. I can see what their valuations are. I can see who's growing the most. And I can say, for example, I want to find Series A or seed stage companies between 20 to 50 million in valuation, roughly. And I want to find who's winning, which of them are winning and by what degree. Is anyone disrupting this market? And I will see them and get it down to, let's say, two that are winning in the space that I care about. And I send them an email. So it's still morning. I still have my cup of coffee. I've gotten to the bottom of it, but it's not even midday yet. I've gone through 11,000 companies. I know who's winning in a market, and I've sent two emails to the winners. So I've cherry-picked the winners and reached out to them with a productivity level that's astronomical. And for some reason, they almost always get back to me. You know, then you have a meeting, and if you like them, you have a second meeting, and if you like them, and then the normal venture capital conversation happens, and you do due diligence for a month or whatever it takes. And yes, okay, to finally get to investing a few million bucks, there's a conventional process. But the front was the advantage, because not only was it incredibly efficient, and by the way, I didn't get on any airplanes. I mean, it was cost effective. But I cheated. I could see who's winning and go right to them and not talk to the other 29 startups that aren't winning, or even ones that are losing secretly. So by being able to secretly see how companies are performing, even private companies, even seed stage companies, it's just a ridiculous advantage for a venture capitalist to have, right? It's unfair. And we're always trying to get better at that too. But there's just one, again, that's another very isolated example of where we're using AI in one application. Now, if I was in Gore, okay, maybe I'm not doing a lot of venture capital, I don't know. But that same capability helps me look at competitors. It helps me look at ecosystem partners, vendors. The visibility into markets, private markets, and how they're performing and what's really happening is, that is the name of the game when it comes to corporate strategy, right? That is the goal. Mm-hmm. And so once you understand what's happening in the market with that level of fidelity, that's how you can get to simulating a new product launch and understanding what's likely to happen given the state of the market at scale. And is this little project with two people and 100K and 6 months to go? And what are their odds within my time horizons of hitting the kinds of goals I want? And if those odds are high enough, I'll take a bet as a corporate innovator. And if they're not, I'm going to probably try to get that team to pivot until it does, or I have to stop. But that's just, I mean, think of how different that is from a conventional innovation process where you're just having people pitch you projects and you're just hope, you know, you bet on the ones you really like the best, and you just kind of hope at least one or two will win, right? That's sort of the traditional way we're here. Mm-hmm. It's just a... we can actuarially look at the goal an executive is trying to hit, half a billion in 5 years or whatever it is, look at their portfolio, understand what they're likely to deliver as an actuarial matter, and then help them change the portfolio till they're going to hit their goal, like statistically. and they understand how many projects they need, how big they are, what they need to do, how much to fund each one. I mean, to make these questions concrete and tangible and real, not just hypothetical or theoretical. Now you can hit a goal because you're engineering a result. You're not spraying and praying, right? But you couldn't do that without spending 20 years working on this stupid thing because we just didn't know enough about the statistics to do this in conventionally, right? Anyway, I now my coffee's kicked in, so I should shut up and let Craig go.
No, that's good. It's right on. I mean, the way we use the tools with Thomas and his team is we would get the project teams themselves involved. So we tried out a few on the small side with a couple people just to learn how we would work together. Then we started engaging individual teams. So this is not something that was done to them. It was something that was done with them. And they could see how the process would shape out and how with their inputs, what the outcomes would be. We could change the inputs. We could look at new outcomes and see if we could change the survivability or the dynamics that they were going to face. And it became very collaborative. And then as more and more projects started seeing this go on, people were reaching out saying, can we do this? I mean, at the end of the game, everybody wants to be successful. There's nobody out there saying, I'm going to come in, do a bad job on a bad product today. It just doesn't happen. But they need the tools to be able to really educate themselves over what the possibilities are. And with these new AI tools, it's becoming much more simpler to go about doing it from an individual effort perspective. A lot of work generating the AI tools, but the individual use of those tools becomes much simpler.
Yeah, and I think that's just driven everything I've done. I think I'm still mad about my project being shut down almost 20 years ago, right? And it's just like, that shouldn't happen. And what do I got to do to make sure that doesn't happen, right? Nobody wins mm-hmm. when innovations fail, right? Just none of us. Mm-hmm. And it's about, okay, what's it going to take? And yeah, you know, start small, but staying with the problem a long time is just, and just, I mean, I never get, I'm always motivated. You know, when I look at these innovation teams, it's just always amazing people, like bright people with incredible backgrounds, really taking a risk to step out of the core to do what the company really needs them and is begging them to do, which is try to create growth. And I mean, these are the people I like, and I don't know, I don't just respect. I mean, these are people you want to spend time with, right? And man, they're just getting punished over and over and over. The same thing happens to them every cycle. They get just, no matter what they do, no individual effort can overcome the systemic problem. And people just don't know what the problem is and how to fix it. So that's what I want to figure out. And again, we've made progress, but there's always more to learn. Because I mean, that's what, and you know, as we know, there's cycles. So these incubation groups or these venture groups or whatever in companies, they get funded. 4 to 6 years later, they get shut down. It doesn't work. Then the company has amnesia a few years later, new bright shiny faces. They do it all over again. And then, you know, and it's this destructive cycle. It doesn't help. It's not good for morale. The best people get mad enough eventually and leave. A lot of them are really successful when they get out and have their own startup. You know, they forget this. But it's just not, you know, we need companies to be able to do this for themselves, but also for those people, right? That just, if there's anyone you don't want to demoralize, it's those people who are going to stick their neck out to do what's right. So yeah, I get fired up, and let's just figure out what the problems are, because they're the same darn problems. We all can recognize them. So, okay, statistically, can we pin them down to a micro set, you know, to a nanometer, and then just fix them systematically? And you can, and my gosh, again, when it works, it's glorious, and it's absolutely not magic or luck. It's repeatable, but it's going to take some capabilities we talk about and structures. So that's why being part of an investment bank became part of my career evolution, because I realized the first several years I thought it was about trying to enlighten innovators to the data and have them change their strategies, which it did, and it's helpful. You can make progress, but then you end up with these great projects that are still failing because they can't get autonomy. So, okay, so now I have to fix the harder problem, which is getting the C-suite to create a structural change, even if the dollar amount is nominal. But it's structural, so you probably need the board involved. You probably need the C-suite to at least bless this all the way through. And in a place like Ducera, where I can actually do that, to create structures, that's what we do. Again, I'm still chasing the same problem, and it's every time you get a little closer to the solution, it's just so glad, because you know, you just keep throwing yourself at the wall, hoping the wall will break, right?
All right, I think we've got time for maybe one question if anyone wants to jump in here real quick before we wrap.
Hi. Oh, I would love to ask a quick question. I'm not sure if my, there yep. we go.
We got you.
Hi, thank you so much. This has been super insightful. I just wanted to call out one of the kind of earlier comments around the need to kind of do your own anthropology work and what you have seen, how you've seen that impact. At Planview, we actually have a tool that does a lot of this kind of scenario planning, but we find that customers that have not done their own work to identify the variables that matter for them and the problems they're trying to solve doesn't help them. Right. And so I'm really curious if you have any kind of best practices or insight into what makes that really effective in a large organization in particular.
Yeah, I mean, just I can in that to your question, I have a very small sample size, which is like, what have I done
that worked better than us?
So, I mean, hey, so maybe not a great statistical answer, but. What I found was you need a passport, if you will, to travel around the company peacefully and be allowed right. into the different groups to get this information. So I did feel very much like every time you have to really respect who you're going to explain that what you're doing. I mean, every time it was a little bit of selling them on look, what I, at the time it was, I'm just trying to, I just was an innovation project that failed. What I'm trying to do is just find out more, learn from the past and figure out what else has come before us so that maybe we can get better at this and don't have to repeat the past. And when you do that, people are generally like disarmed and very helpful. The reason I mentioned that though, and why you'd even bring that up is because I'd say 80, 90% of the people I encountered in the company were actually quite helpful and eager to share what their experience was. I have tons of tapes because I even had the little tapes. This was a long time ago. Like, more than I could ever re-listen to hours, but I mean, really working at this anthropology, but there's another 10 to 20% of the people you'll meet that are very threatened or very guarded or very suspicious of what you're doing. And they will, they'll actively work against you if you can't get them to understand that you're earnestly trying to just do something good. Because a lot of people are, you know, they might have failed in their project. Maybe now they're a VP or something. They're like, wait a minute, you want to look at my old projects? Like, whoa, is this a witch hunt? Are you going to embarrass me? Are you going to, like, there was one company we collaborated with where the chief innovation officer was trying to do this. You know, it's a publicly traded company, but he couldn't get the CFO who literally had all the old, I mean, this is a modern age. He literally had the old project files printed and in a metal file cabinet with a lock and would not give the actual key to the chief innovation officer, because I don't know what he was protecting, but it was this idea that, no, wait a minute, is knowledge power? Are you threatening me? It just, you know, I think really it's just as simple as, you know, going out there and trying to get people bought into what you're doing and have the anthropology session. That's what I did. Eventually you have the spreadsheet and you start looking for more discrete questions. You are going to have to go back to those people a lot. So you want to keep that relationship fluid and promise to share back whatever you learn. I ended up bugging a lot of those because the first person you talk to gives you some old slides, you put them in. 6 months later, when you've got a lot more data, you realize there's a lot of empty fields and you're going to have to go back to that first person a lot to say, by the way, okay, do you have anything about this? Or so you need everyone's patience. So they have to believe that they're going to benefit from the outcome. You're going to share it. That's one best practice. But there is a lot of buy-in. You just need to keep making a point of getting, because a lot of people who would sabotage you aren't going to tell you that. But they're just afraid that you have an agenda. So again, that's not a huge help probably, but those are some of the watch outs that I experienced.
Thanks.
All right, we'll wrap there. We're right at time. So huge thank you to Thomas and Greg for coming and sharing their experiences today, and to all of you for joining and contributing to the conversation. So thanks, everyone, and have a wonderful rest of your March.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.